From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman.
And I'm Russ Parsons.
And you're listening to Good Foods Thanksgiving Special.
So for the past few years, I haven't cooked Thanksgiving dinner. Friends of ours have cooked it, and there's turkey, of course, and there are Brussels sprouts and mashed potatoes and cranberry sauce, which I usually make. And then there's lasagna. There's one guy whose mother always made lasagna for Thanksgiving, and so that's what he brings to dinner.
Because it wouldn't be Thanksgiving for him without it.
Because it wouldn't be Thanksgiving without lasagna. And you know what's funny? The lasagna's finished before the turkey.
Of course. I don't know about you, but I am still in Thanksgiving denial. Could there be one meal that brings out more idiosyncrasies than this one? I don't think so. For cooks, it is at once our most beloved and dreaded meal of the year. I think actually it's more dreaded for cooks and more beloved by eaters. I am so happy to welcome Russ Parsons back for the third year in a row. It's amazing. 3 years.
Are we that old?
He's going to help me co-host this Thanksgiving program. Russ is the food editor at the LA Times, and the two of us combined, how many Thanksgivings do you think we've managed to prepare? A lot, wouldn't you say?
Lots. We're not going to go there. Thanksgiving is one of those meals where for cooks, I think a lot of times it just becomes, especially cooks who don't cook all the time, it's just this big stress ball. And I think the message that we bring every year is just relax, have a little fun. People are going to love it. You're going to do great.
So I don't know. There's something about this year. I feel like I don't really want to postpone gratification a lot. So why don't we start with dessert? What do you think?
Let's go.
I know that we both are besotted with admiration for Dori Greenspan. I mean, after all, she's the kind of gal who has lasagna at Thanksgiving, which tells you a lot about her. And she is, of course, one of the great cookbook authors of our particular time.
She is amazing. She's won a total of 6 James Beard and IACP Awards for her books. And her latest, Baking Chez Moi, is, of course, fabulous, too.
And what I'm about to say might shock some of you who are listening, but I've made a conscious decision not to talk about pie today. I think I'm actually a bit pied out. So this Thanksgiving, I wanted to start with something festive that I could make ahead. And you know what? Paging through her book, I just think we should talk about baba au rhum.
That's a great idea. I mean, it's one of those dishes that I remember when I was starting cooking, it was, you could find it. It went out of fashion for some kind of strange reason, but you can make it ahead of time. It's a crowd pleaser and, you know, very important, especially for family dinners. There's a lot of rum involved. Everybody will love baba.
So let's get Dori in here to tell us what it is.
Baba is such a cute word, isn't it? I mean, it sounds like just a little bundle of something delicious. And that, in fact, is what a baba au rhum is. So it's a small yeast cake that you want to be a dry cake. And so after you make a baba au rhum, you let it stale for a day. The better to take in rum, 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 and more rum. And so the cake is soaked in rum and then served with cream. And these days, people are doing so many things with baba au rhum now. So if you buy a baba from a pastry shop, you might get it on a little foil saucer. And that's holding the syrup that's soaked through the baba. If you get it in a restaurant, oh, and there are some pastry shops that the baba is whole. The cream comes in a little container, and there's a little capsule of rum that's put into the baba the way like the way a pin is put into a pin cushion. And then when you lift the little capsule, the rum soaks into the baba.
Wow.
It's pretty great. But if you go to a restaurant these days in France and order a baba, you'll get the baba that's been soaked in syrup. It'll come in a little saucer. You'll have heavy cream, whipped cream, or creme fraiche. And then a bottle of rum will be put on the table. And you can re-soak and re-soak the baba.
To me, what has always intrigued me about baba is actually the gluten structure of them. I was introduced to them. It was one of my first food jobs ever. I was an undergraduate at UCLA, and I got a job as a counter girl at Paris Pastry in Westwood, which was one of our really good bakeries at the time. And of course, I talked my way into the back, and I used to watch them make their baba, and they used to let them they used to keep them around, so they were really stale.
As they should have, exactly.
And what's fascinating to me is how once you soak it, you can actually see the strands holding that liquid together.
Yes. Oh, yes. So the baba is kind of, it's almost like a, I want to say it's like a poor brioche. So that it's not as rich as a brioche, but you're beating it and beating it and beating it to get that structure so that it's the dough comes together and you think, oh, I've made such a pretty yeast dough. And then you start adding eggs and butter and it kind of falls apart and then it comes together again. And you're really beating, beating, beating to get that structure that will hold. And the traditional baba shape is a baba mold is like a...
It almost looks like a cork.
Exactly. So the mold itself is just a cylinder. And then when the baba rises in it and when it's baked, you get that puff on top that's, yes, like a cork. I make my baba in muffin tins because I want everybody to bake, and it's not so easy to find baba molds. So I do them in a muffin tin and then cut them in half, soak them, and put cream in the center.
And in your book, you describe how chefs are going way beyond just a simple whipped cream. Like there's passion fruit and there's...
Well, because I love desserts like this, because the baba itself is truly plain. And because it's plain, you can do anything you want with it. You could, I mean, it wouldn't be a baba au rum, but you could soak it with a fruit syrup. You could make it non-alcoholic. You can do chocolate cream in it, or you can fill it. It's beautiful if it's filled with berries or, ooh, I just thought of this. What if you were to make a cranberry? I mean, we're talking Thanksgiving. Wouldn't
right.
that be great
oh.
to do a kind of maybe cranberry and raspberry and orange kind of sauce, jam or something, and use that in the baba.
And an orange-flavored rum, maybe?
Oh, wouldn't that be nice? Yeah, it's really something you can make your own. You can riff on it.
And infuse, when you're making the syrup, infuse some warm spices into it. So some cinnamon.
Star anise.
But what also intrigued me is there's another recipe in the book that I thought, oh, this is perfect for Thanksgiving for people who don't embrace the cranberry, and that's Laurence slow-roasted spiced pineapple.
This is one of my favorite recipes in the book. It would be perfect for Thanksgiving, even if you do embrace cranberries, even if you do have a pumpkin pie and a pecan pie, this would just be beautiful on the table and it would disappear. So the recipe is, okay, so let me just tell you about—
Who is Laurent?
Okay, let me tell you about Laurent. So I get my hair cut in Paris by Isabel. Isabel doesn't cook, but Isabel always goes out to eat and has great restaurant recommendations. Laurent cuts hair in the chair next to Isabel, and he cooks on weekends, the only time he has to cook. So I always try to get my hair cut right after the weekend so I can see what Laurent has made. And he made this pineapple one weekend. And I said, it's gorgeous. It almost looks candied or confit. I said, what is it? He said, oh, you know, pineapple and some jam, little orange juice, some booze if you've got it, you know, and every spice you've got in the cupboard, just a little here and there. And I went home and I made it, and it didn't look like his picture. And I came back and I said, help, it's just not the same. It took me 3 times and as many haircuts to get the recipe. Finally, I said, you know, I've just used a few tablespoons of jam and it doesn't seem right. He said, well, of course it doesn't. You need the whole jar. And so it's a full jar of jam, some orange juice, some booze, or not. You could use more orange juice. And the pineapple is cut. and then baste it kind of every time you pass the oven for about 2 hours.
So what's the texture of this like?
Oh, it's wonderful. So the pineapple softens, and it's totally permeated by the syrup. So it's soft-ish, and I know that candied isn't a texture, but you get that feeling of something that's just been soaked in the syrup.
Don't you think it would be good with the baba?
Don't I? Yes. Oh, yeah. Come on. Forget the pie. Right. Yeah, you were right in the first place.
Well, there has to be a couple of them. But I just think this sounds so delicious. And I think we're all really lucky that your hair is very short. So you need to go get it cut often.
Well, I like this recipe is also, it's like the baba in that it's not so much a recipe as a structure. You know, I'm sitting here thinking about what you could do with it. Just crazy stuff because we're in Southern California, but maybe like lime and serrano with it. Just a little bit, just to give it a little bit of that green heat because it's a great structure and then you make it your own.
What I try to do when I'm working on recipes, and part of it is that I just can't help thinking about, oh yeah, this is the recipe, but then you could do this or you could do this or you could do this. So I always have a section in the French books, it's called Bunny Day, good idea. In the American books, it's called Playing Around, to try and give people ideas of what else they can do. You can't change a formula in pastry, but you can change a flavor. You can change the form of something. And I love giving people, if they need it, permission to just go crazy in the kitchen and do what you really love with a recipe. And so, yeah, you've chosen two recipes that could be easily personalized and become house specials.
Thank you so much, Dori. What a pleasure having you here.
I am so happy to be with the two of you. I'm going to stay here.
Thanks, Dori. It's wonderful again.
Great to see you.
That was Dori Greenspan. Her new book is Baking Chez Moi.
Her recipes for both baba au rhum and Laurence slow roasted spiced pineapple, I'm definitely making that, are on the Good Food blog.
Coming up, we'll go into the void.
Ooh.
Michael Ruhlman says cooking a better turkey is all about understanding the cavity inside the bird.
Plus, what pairs well with turkey, cranberry sauce, and that wild card, stuffing. We've got some domestic wine ideas that will help you get through Thanksgiving next.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food's Thanksgiving special. Joining me for this hour is my partner in crime here, Russ Parsons of the LA Times.
I think it's turkey time, Evan.
Definitely. And to guide us through the process, we called on who else but Michael Ruhlman, that author who takes us through a lot of techniques in a really painstaking way, sort of busting myths and making something that might be a little difficult actually seem easy. I learned a lot from his technique, two things in particular, the cooking vessel, which we'll get to in a minute. But first, I asked Michael to focus on the cavity, which in a big bird is a giant void right in the center. And it's really to our advantage to understand how to make that work for us.
That is the critical component in cooking all birds, is that cavity, because when left open, especially if with an untrussed bird, all that hot air circulates within the bird and overcooks the breast. That's why the breast overcooks. So if we fill that with something, not stuffing necessarily, though it can be, of course, but stuffing is really heavy and that's really dense and that has to get hot. But I like to put aromatics inside the bird. To flavor all the stuff that's going to go on to flavor the sauce and the gravy. It also keeps air from circulating so freely around within the bird, overcooking the breast from the inside out.
Is that one of the reasons why we want to truss the bird?
That's the main reason we want to truss the bird.
That's so fascinating. I mean, in all my years, I never thought of that.
another chef told me this, and then it made sense, and I started thinking more about it. And then as people ask me how to roast a chicken, the most easiest thing to do in the world, and they say, what's your recipe? It's not a recipe. But I, even if you don't feel comfortable trussing, I say stick an onion or a lemon in there just to keep the air from circulating, and that will give you a much more juicy breast so that you can properly cook the thighs.
And the other thing that you say, which I find might be a bit hard for some people to do, is you talk about the difference between cooking a 20-pound bird, which I think a lot of people do, and a smaller bird.
Yeah, well, it's really hard to cook that size bird. In fact, I don't know any chef who doesn't recommend cooking the breast and the legs separately, at least at some point during the cooking. And I do, even in roast, recommend that you take the breast out when the breast is perfect, because it stays hot forever. People think it's going to get cold. It stays hot for 45 minutes in there, finishes cooking, and those legs and thighs need time to tenderize in the oven. So they go back in the oven while the breast rests.
So you're cooking the bird whole, and then when the breast is done, we take the bird out. Do we take the whole thing out of the pan to carve it up?
What I do is I put it on a cutting board and I let it sit for about 5 minutes. Now, the breast should be a little bit undercooked at this point, because the longer it rests, the more it will keep cooking, and keep cooking evenly at a very gentle temperature. Keep it on the bone. You don't want to ruin it, because then it will start cooling. It will be undercooked on the inside. But if you leave it on the bone, it will continue to cook while those legs cook at an even higher temperature.
So we put the legs back in the pan, and we put them back in the oven, and we turn the temperature up?
It really doesn't matter. You can leave it at the same temperature. You're not going to cook them like for 5 hours, so you just at the same temperature is fine. And you're going to let it cook for a half hour. And during that half hour, you can make your gravy, you can make a cocktail, you can entertain your guests, you can look at the football game, you can relax. Because so much of your other things will, I hope, already have been completed. So much of this is just planning ahead.
And when you have the bird in your pan, and I have to say from the photographs in the book, you're using a pan that's more low-sided than I would imagine a lot of people use.
Yeah, another problem with roasting birds is they cook it in a vessel that traps the steam in, which, one, lowers the temperature, and two, prevents the skin from getting crispy. So I would roast a turkey in a very shallow pan, in a large cast iron skillet, or any kind of skillet, as opposed to a roasting pan.
You also talk about how you will sometimes slice down the breast and reheat it in the juices of the turkey.
I think that is the absolute critical part of serving a hot and juicy slice of breast, is to finish its cooking in moisture, because as we know, the breast is the dry part. And if you let it just sort of gently poach in that some warm turkey stock or whatever kind of stock that you've prepared to make in advance, or chicken broth or whatever you're using, some sort of liquid to keep it warm and moist, that's the best way to do it. And the legs and thighs can also go in that, and they can sit for an hour. And then when you're ready to heat, you just put that pan back on top of the stovetop, bring the liquid up to a light simmer, and you've reheated everything right through, and people get a hot plate of turkey, which is always the hardest thing to do at a Thanksgiving meal.
Sounds really delicious.
It's easy and delicious. People freak out at Thanksgiving, and they need not.
Yeah, you know, they do freak out. It's the big bird. The big bird thing makes people go crazy.
Yeah, and it's too bad, because cooking should be fun and easy, and you should relax and enjoy the smells of the bird cooking. You should enjoy your family. You should enjoy the whole process. It's our one unique holiday, and it's centered around food, and we need to appreciate that and recognize the fundamental nature of food to our families, to our health, to our communities.
I couldn't have said it better. Cheers.
Thanks, Evan. Cheers to you.
That was Michael Ruhlman. His new book is Ruhlman's How to Roast. We've got an extended interview and his foolproof turkey recipe on the Good Food blog. Russ, I know you are a proponent of the dry brine. How are you going to cook your bird this year?
Well, I'm certainly going to do dry brine, but I'm not exactly sure which seasoned salt I'm going to use. I really like the lemon and lemon zest and rosemary one. That's really nice.
Yeah, that's a standard classic.
But I'm kind of feeling like sage and bay now. You know, it seems very California and very Thanksgiving, so I might go with that.
I always love listening to how people in the industry handle their own personal Thanksgiving meal. I asked Jonathan Gold about this recently, too, and as you can imagine, he's cooked with every method possible and every ingredient imaginable.
I did some really odd turkeys over the years, as I'm sure everybody has. I mean, there was some that I loved. There was a Cuban turkey that I rubbed with lemon and garlic and oil and put lemon and garlic inside and baked till it was crisp and it smelled like Cuba. It was wonderful. I really love doing the Ken Hom Chinatown turkey. Have you ever done that one?
No, I never have. What did you do?
First, there's a really sort of complicated sticky rice stuffing that you make, which is delicious. But you tent the bird with foil and you steam it for a few hours. And then for the last hour or so, you take it off. And the skin crisps and becomes absolutely magnificent. I mean, almost, not quite Peking duck, but in the family of Peking duck. There was the year that we all decided to do wet brine turkey, which made the turkey taste exactly like the ham. And the drippings were unbearably salty, and so you couldn't really make gravy in the right way. There was a year that we all did dry brine turkey, which actually I still love dry brine turkey. Barbara Kafka got everybody cooking their turkey in like an hour and 15 minutes at 500 degrees, which completely fills the kitchen with smoke, but is actually a pretty good bird. And there was the year that everybody did the really slow-cooked turkey at 250 degrees, where we all sort of worried about bacterial poisoning at the end.
See, that's the turkey I grew up with. That's the turkey my mother made every year, where we would stuff the turkey, fill the turkey with the stuffing, put it in at night at like 10 o'clock at night at 250 degrees, and in the morning, at like 6 in the morning, you would wake up, the entire house would smell like Thanksgiving, and I had that bird, oh, it has to be for 30 years in a row. Nobody ever died.
You're alive today. So is your mom, far into her 90s, so apparently it has salubrious qualities as well. At the LA Times, for a while, in the earliest 90s, we came up in the test kitchen with, I guess they called it Times turkey for a while, where the turkey was stuffed under the skin instead of in the cavity. You cooked it at a fairly high heat. The stuffing theoretically basted the breast meat. It was pretty delicious, but it looked really weird. It was like a Arnold Schwarzenegger of a lumpy turkey that came out. And everybody was freaked out by it. And also because the cooking time was relatively short, let's just say there were a lot of phone calls that year about like bloodiness at the in the thighs. I think we eventually like said, you know, take it out and like cook the thighs separately for the last part of it after you do the presentation and then everything's fine. And it worked out just swell.
So did any of those that you talked about, the Ken Hom turkey or the Cuban turkey, did anything make a second year? I mean, did you go back and redo it? Or do you feel the need every single year to do something different?
Weirdly enough, I do almost the same turkey every year now. The novelty turkeys have gone away. And I almost want to like throw rocks at the people who say, no, we shouldn't have turkeys. We should all have our own individual Cornish game hens.
I can't. That would just be the most disappointing Thanksgiving ever.
But in editorial meetings at food magazines, you have people who have run recipes for Thanksgiving turkeys for the last 25 years of their life.
Yeah. This year, I really discovered in the last few years of Angeli that for me, the best way to do the turkey was to confit the legs and as a sop to invited guests who must have white meat. I do the Italianate butterflied turkey breast lined with a rosemary butter and prosciutto, roll it up and roast it. Remember, of course, that I have an oven that is only 14 by 14 inches.
Sometimes I think we should have a Kickstarter campaign to buy Evan an oven. It's been decades. Oh, I did one year that was sort of a turkey in porchetta, like so stuffing it with garlic and rosemary and chopped pancetta and a ton of fennel pollen and rubbing some of that mixture all over the bird. And man, did that make the kitchen smell great. I'm starting to have ideas for this year too.
See, it's endless. It is endless. Happy Thanksgiving, Jonathan.
Happy Thanksgiving, Evan.
Russ, do you remember the Times turkey that Jonathan was talking about?
Yeah, you know, actually, it's funny because that was one of my first big projects when I came to the Times 20 years ago. Ruth Reichel wanted me to reinvent the turkey, and I think we called it something like the ultimate turkey, which, you know, we might have done when we were 20 years younger. And if I remember right, I think we even did a variation on that with where we spatchcocked it. It was amazing because the turkey would be done in like an hour.
You need a big oven for that.
You need a big oven for a spatchcocked turkey.
We've got a discussion about the big bird because, folks, that's really all it is, a big bird, on my Facebook page right now. We want to know what ingredients and what method you're following this year. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. And now to another stumper, wine.
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, we've all been there. You're kind of standing in the wine shop trying to figure out what's going to go with turkey, with cranberry sauce, with sweet potatoes. I mean, there's not a natural pour. So, I mean, for me, what I usually do is just pick up a couple bottles of Beaujolais Nouveau. Number one, it comes in right at that time. It's fresh, it's fruity, and it's not going to overpower the food, and the food isn't going to overpower some really special wine. But there are a lot of other options as well. And so we've got Jill Bernheimer of Domaine LA here with some suggestions.
Well, I think a lot of people have a tendency to want to drink domestic wines.
It's an American holiday.
It's an American holiday. And then I think people tend to think of a special occasion as being appropriate for something like a high-end Cabernet. I don't think that's the right choice for Thanksgiving for the flavors that you're talking about.
Why?
Well, turkey itself isn't the most dynamic of proteins. And then you have a lot of different flavors going on with all the sides.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think what you need is a versatile wine, something that will go with a lot of different flavors. And as you said, Beaujolais isn't a bad choice for that. But I think there are a lot of domestic alternatives to that that make interesting choices that might not be household name grape varieties, but that can be fun and interesting to serve.
So I want to serve American for Thanksgiving this year. What should I be looking for?
So there's this one grape variety called Valdiguié that I want to talk about. And Valdiguié until 2007, was referred to as Napa Gamay. It was long confused with Gamay, considered to be the same grape variety. It's actually from southwest France, and it's its own genetic thing. But it shares a lot of things in common with Gamay. It's a little fruity. It's lighter bodied. It's often made with carbonic maceration, which is a technique whereby the grapes are sort of sealed off in a container, and then carbon dioxide is pumped through. They begin to ferment inside their own skins, and then they're pressed. So they get sort of high degrees of aromatics, fruitiness, and not a lot of tannic structure. Valdiguié itself is a grape variety that has good amounts of acidity. So you combine fruitiness, acidity, which will help with balancing a lot of the fat that you'll get in a lot of the Thanksgiving side mm-hmm. dishes especially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a pleasant, lighter-bodied, lower-alcohol grape variety that will, as you say, meld with a lot of the flavors, not overpower anything in particular. It's more interesting, I think, than a lot of Pinot Noirs, especially at the price point where you'll find Valdiguié, which is in the $20 or under range. Mm-hmm. And it's just an interesting alternative to Gamay.
That sounds like one of those kinds of fringe wines like Rhone's used to be in California, where there's just a few producers who are starting to make it now. Who are some producers that we ought to be thinking about?
So someone that's been making it for a long time is Jay Lohr It's not the most interesting iteration, but it's available. There were 6,000 acres of Valdigi planted until the 70s when it really fell out of fashion. Now there are really only about 300 acres. So it's a very, very small production grape variety. It is on the more obscure end. Two producers that I really love who produce about 300 case production runs of Valdigi each year are Brock Sellers, which is based in Berkeley, California, and then Folk Machine, which is based in Sonoma. And it's a pretty late ripening grape. So as I said, you get higher acidity levels and lower alcohol levels. Mm-hmm. That's the other tip I usually give people for Thanksgiving is stay away from high alcohol wines. You're already eating a sleep-inducing meal, you don't need wine to put you over the top early in the day.
And it's usually a family meal, so it's usually – there's plenty of volatility without that.
Correct.
Okay, so aside from Valdigi, are there some other suggestions?
I have a few other wines that are sort of my go-to wines this year. One is a Rhone-style blend from La Clarine Farm. It's called Jambalaya, and it's a really interesting blend because Jambalaya is sort of a mishmash, and Hank Beckmeyer, the winemaker, is making this with a combination of both red and white grapes. So it has Syrah, it has Mourvedre, and it has Grenache Noir, but it also has about 25% Marsan in the blend. It gives it a lot of lift. It gives it some body and nuance. Hank calls it his equivalent of a nouveau. So it's meant to be a lighter, fresher style wine. And it has a lot of sort of cranberry and rhubarb-ness to it.
Are there any white wines that you'd recommend?
For whites, I lean a little bit more towards orange, which is a skin-fermented white. Mm-hmm. It's a white wine
that's a category, right?
It's a category of wines. The wines aren't actually made from oranges. But it's an interesting and controversial category.
Yeah. What is the when it's fermented on the skins, what kind of quality does that add to the wine that would make it appropriate for this?
What happens is the wine takes on structure, tannin, and texture that's more like a red wine, and it also takes on a lot of savory notes. Mm-hmm. And the savory notes in particular, herbaceousness, you know, rosemary, thyme, even sort of citrus peel, all of that comes from the skins. You don't get that when you freshly press off the juice. And those flavors, again, are all very complementary to what's on the Thanksgiving table.
It sounds almost like a red wine in masquerade.
It is. I think if you pulled the old trick of pouring a wine in a black glass, which sometimes is a trick done with sommeliers, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell whether it was a white or a red wine when you smell it or taste it. It definitely has, you know, the essence of white wine grapes, but it has a lot of the structure of a red wine.
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I think cider is something to consider.
Oh, that's a great idea.
And cider would usually be considered something you would have before or after a meal.
Well, hard cider or sweet cider?
Well, hard cider can be sweet or dry. Mm-hmm. But I'm thinking about, in particular, there's a cider I love from Sonoma County. It's a cidery, I don't know what you call it, called Tilted Shed. And they're working with apples the same way a lot of winemakers are working with grapes. They really believe that terroir affects apples the same way and that you shouldn't just – not every apple is suitable for cider. They make a variety of ciders ranging from very dry to off-dry. And I have one in stock called Graviva, which is made from Gravenstein apples, and the aromas of those apples really come through. And this is a slightly off-dry cider, but I think it would work well during the main event. I don't think you would have to have it as an aperitif or as dessert.
Well, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. Sounds like you're going to have a great dinner, and thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Jill Bernheimer of the Maine LA, and tomorrow, Sunday afternoon, she's going to be pouring some of these wines at her Melrose Avenue shop. Stop by between 2 and 5 if you want to taste the Valdigi, the cider, and that orange wine we were just talking about. They sound so interesting.
In a minute, squash. Roasting, steaming, glazing, boiling. We're going deep with fall's favorite vegetable. Stay close.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleinman.
And I'm Russ Parsons.
And you're listening to Good Food's Thanksgiving special on KCRW. Russ, I think for most people, it's impossible to talk about a Thanksgiving dinner without at least alluding, if not fully embracing, squash. Winter squash just seems to show up in every form and not just at the end as a pumpkin pie.
I mean, I think winter squash should be embraced. It's almost, it's not a blank canvas. It has a flavor of its own, but it pairs so well with so many other flavors. You know, you can go in the herbal direction with it with sage and rosemary. You could go in the sweet direction, and it's great with nuts. There's so many different things that you can do with it. I think, you know, embrace the squash.
It also pairs really well with bright, high tropical notes like lime, a little bit of heat spice.
Absolutely. Yogurt. Yogurt and squash is really, really wonderful. And you know what? Butter. I mean, is there anything that was made for butter like winter squash? It's
so
just
good.
The most amazing thing.
And especially, it really makes a difference when you make brown butter between using a high-fat butter or a high-moisture butter.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I made a brown butter, actually, last night and with a really delicious high-fat butter, and I was like, oh, my goodness.
Well, and you know, we've got so many different butters that are on the market now. I went out and splurged on some of that French butter, the Beurre de Barat, and I made a puree with just winter squash, and I added butter, and I thought, now I'll see what I'm going to do with it. And I tasted it, and it's like, I'm not going to do anything with it. This is unbelievable just as it is. And it was, I mean, the simplest thing, roasted winter squash, butter, puree it. I mean, the texture
Fork.
Was amazing, and whew.
What is your default winter squash?
Well, you can find all different kinds of squashes in the market now. I mean, they're reliably a half a dozen. But the one that I usually fall back on, unless there's some pressing reason otherwise, is butternut.
And why is that?
To me, butternut has the best combination of flavor and of texture. I did this years ago where I tasted a whole bunch of different – I geeked out, and I tested a whole – every type of squash that I could find. And then compared them. And it was interesting because you think of winter squash as being one thing, but it's actually a range of things. And like at one end, you've got things like delicata, which is very vegetal. I mean, it's almost a zucchini kind of flavor. And at the other, you've got butternut, which is rich and almost kind of a caramely flavor. Texture, you know, you can go from spaghetti squash, which is nothing but fiber, you know, just bland fiber, which isn't necessarily bad because you can do lots of different things with it texture-wise, but, you know, to, you know, again, like butternut or kabocha, where it's just a rich, creamy texture that really, really holds up well. And as we were talking about a couple minutes ago, the great thing about butternut now is that they're breeding it so that it's mostly neck.
Which is so great because I remember when I first started cooking professionally and you would get butternut squashes in the wintertime and they would be all bulb with the seeds, such a pain to peel. And now they're just a joy.
I know. And you can cook it in so many different ways.
Which is, I understand, your latest geek out project.
Yeah. I've always been interested in kind of like the very basics of cooking. You know, when you get away from the recipe, like how does food work? And so my default method of cooking my default squash has always been roasting it. But it's mainly because I never really thought about it. You know, I roasted it, and so, well, I'll roast it. I thought I ought to examine that a little bit more closely. So I took butternut squash, cubed it, peeled it and cubed it, and I cooked it five ways. I steamed some of it. I boiled some of it, or simmered. It wasn't actually a rolling boil. I deep fried some of it. Of course, I roasted some of it. And I glazed some of it. And glazing, you know, you start with a little bit of fat, some water. When it gets tender, you take the lid off and turn the heat all the way up, and it makes almost like a sauce out of the juices and the fat.
So, Russ, I don't want to get to the winner just yet. I want to start by dissecting a few of these methods. Let's start with what we might imagine to be the most pure, steaming.
Steaming was the most pure. The flavor was very clean. It was somewhat sweet, and the texture was slightly granular. I mean, it was a little bit beyond fibrous. It wasn't quite fibrous, but it was a little bit granular.
And what would you do with steamed squash? How would you take it to the next level to actually create a recipe?
Well, steamed squash I would use for warm salads. Something where you really want just that very pure flavor, and you're going to do other things with it. Like you're going to... I'm trying to think of polite ways to say you're going to actually make it taste like something. But essentially, you know, like maybe nuts, herbs, some chopped pistachios, or, you know, of course, I mean, there's just a natural affinity for like pepitas and pumpkin seeds and things like that.
So there's a dish that I've made for years, an Italian traditional dish called zucca all'agrodolce, which is like a bitter, sweet squash that can be made either with summer squash like zucchini or winter squash. And when I do it with the butternut, I'll cut half moons and then I'll saute it in an abundant amount of olive oil. So it's sort of floating in the pan. Cook it on both sides till it's nice and brown and yielding when you pierce it with a paring knife. Then I take it out and I drench it with a sweet and sour sauce made from red wine vinegar, sugar, mint, and chopped garlic. That is really...
That sounds really good. And do you like maybe some white raisins and pine nuts?
Well, that would be like gilding the lily. But it's a wonderful antipasti, though, and a wonderful sort of fresh way of using the squash.
That sounds great. And I do that sometimes, something that I learned from one of Yotam Ottolenghi's books, because roasting was my traditional default. He did something that I thought was really cool where he didn't even peel it. He just sliced it in thin half moons and roasted it that way. It gets done in about 20 minutes. You get that full developed flavor, and then he serves it with, you know, like an Ottolenghi thing, you know, like lots of cilantro, lots of lime juice,
tahini.
Pomegranate seed. I'm sure there's tahini in there someplace, But it's such an interesting, you know, it's almost like a shortcut. You couldn't use it in every application, but it made me appreciate, you know, the whole squash as a center of a dish rather than the puree.
Yeah, we actually had Yotam in the studio a few weeks ago to talk about his newest book, Plenty More. And as I was flipping through the book, of course, I had Thanksgiving on the brain. And there was this roasted sweet potato dish that I think would also be a perfect Thanksgiving side for those of us in Southern California. So I asked him what spices and herbs he adds to balance sweet potatoes.
The touch is to add a little bit of bitterness to them. It's got orange juice and some Angostura bitters, which are used by barmen all over the world to add infuse food with some bitterness. And it works really, really well together. The orange, the bitterness, and the sweet potato kind of mixes together so nicely. And there's also tons of chili there and garlic and hard herbs. So it has everything that the fall, the autumn has to offer on one plate.
Is it a mash?
It's not a mash. These are just wedges roasted in a very high oven, and it turns into almost caramel. The sugars and the orange reduce, and the wedges are kind of coated in this wonderful sticky sauce.
That sounds so good.
It is.
Especially for those of us who don't like really cloying sweet potato and yam recipes.
Yes, because it's got that bitterness.
Okay, now give us a mash.
Give you a mash. I'll give you a great mash. I've got a mash made out of a couple of mixed root vegetables. There is celery root, carrots, and squash, and some sweet potatoes all mashed together. But it's not mashed to the end of its life. It's actually more crushed. And then you've got some pie lentils folded through. So it's a mash with some texture. And I think it's quite nice just for change to have a mash that has a little bit of texture. And it's got some maple syrup. It's beautifully sweet and perfect for the season, but it doesn't have that kind of uniform consistency that a mash normally has. And that's topped with whole shallots that have been braising with red wine, some black peppercorns, a bit of sugar, and a couple of bay leaves, and they're cooked for a very long time until they soak all this wonderful red wine. And it's the most perfect vegetarian option for the Thanksgiving table, because it's got the shallots are kind of the main course, and they're served over the mash, and it looks great and tastes even better.
Okay. I'm getting hungry, Evan. Too bad we had dessert first today.
Well, let's just have more dessert then. No, just kidding. We have to have our vegetables, which is why next we're off to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out what LA chefs are cooking up this Thanksgiving holiday. Listening to their ideas might completely blow your plans.
Stay close.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and my co-host today is Russ Parsons, food editor at the LA Times.
You know, Evan, you can't talk about Thanksgiving in Southern California without a visit to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. I mean, that's the biggest day of the market year for them. The vendors come in, they can start selling as soon as they get there, and there will probably already be a line of people waiting to buy whatever they have.
Yeah, the really diehard shoppers want to get in and they want to get out. But it is an incredibly fun day too, because it's packed with both chefs and home cooks. Everybody's in a great mood, sharing recipes. You run into people that you haven't seen in a while that you know. It's really a lot of fun. And just the colors are there. Still the last of the summer stuff and all the fall. So to get the creative juices flowing, we caught up with some of LA's most devoted farmers market customers, the chefs, and some of the farmers too, to find out what they're shopping for at the market this Thanksgiving week.
I'm Ari Tamor. I'm the chef and owner at Alma Restaurant in downtown Los Angeles.
My name is Jessica Coslow, and I am the chef owner of Squirrel in Silver Lake.
I like to do root vegetables like carrots or parsnips, and so I'm going to get my carrots from McGrath if they have them, and then parsnips from Weiser.
I'll be making a delicata squash, basically warm salad with brown butter vinaigrette.
I like to start a fire in a fireplace and then kind of rake the coals from the back to the front and just drop the vegetables straight into the coals and just let them sit there and keep turning them. Basically what you're doing is you're caramelizing the vegetables over direct heat straight on embers. So they're not gonna catch fire. They've kind of burnt out, but there's still this kind of like hearty residual heat, and it infuses the food with like this really intense, but at the same time very subtle smokiness and richness, and it's really like a wonderful way to cook big root vegetables.
The reason why I love delicata squash is that, you know, it's really easy for everyone to use. We can quickly cut it in half, de-seed it, and roast it in small pieces with the skin on. So it doesn't take a lot of effort to use delicata squash and make it for a lot of people. And then I'll make a brown butter vinaigrette that I'll toss the squash in after they're roasted off and fold in fava leaves and broccoli cover crop leaves that I'll be getting from Milliken here at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
My name's Alex Weiser from Weiser Family Farms. This Thanksgiving, our family's really excited about parsnips because the last few years we had kind of crop failures on them, and we miss them, and they do so well where we farm in Tehachapi. They're extra sweet and have great flavor, and it's one of my favorite vegetables. It reminds me of my grandfather. It was his favorite, so.
I'm Becky Terry, Terry Ranch, Dinuba, California. It's a little bit of a tradition at our house that we deep pit our turkey, and then we actually stuff that bird before we put it in the ground with quince, because we grow them. We also put in oranges for a little bit of citrus. We also rub that turkey with onions and garlic on the outside, along with black pepper.
My name's Nathan Pezzo. I own Maggie's Farm. We sell lettuce and herbs, and my Thanksgiving specialty is a boned quail pot pie. My fiancée, Sherry Farah, had a whole bunch of boned out quail that she had for an event, and she had too many, and it was right around Thanksgiving. And I thought, why don't we take those little guys and put them inside of a pot pie? And so we truss them, tie them up, and sear them so they're browned on the outside. And then we line them up like sections of an orange inside of a large pie tray, and fill in the inside with yummy, like traditional chicken pot pie, creamy peas, carrots, things like that. Put a top over it, bake the whole thing, and that's what we eat on Thanksgiving. Turkey, I grow the turkeys, I prepare the turkeys, and I don't really want to eat the turkeys at the end of that.
Hi, I'm Matthew Bianconello, and I've got a few things that I'm interested in to give people for Thanksgiving. One is an incredible guavas from Garcia Farms that I'm just infusing into an organic tequila number 123. You just put that in there for a week and serve it straight when people come.
My name is Steve Sampson from Soto Restaurant. This Thanksgiving, I'm actually cooking for my whole family, so I'll just go around. I love to buy some of the greens from Coleman Farms, potatoes from Weiser Farms. I want to do a dessert with the oranges, and so either Mud Creek or Polito.
My favorite, which is only in, we're in the second week now, is of course Laura from JJ's Lone Dot. I'm sure everyone is going to talk about these, is the Hachia Persimmons, which this year I'm doing with my wild cactus infused tequila with persimmons and sage, which is really, really great.
With the Weiser Farms potatoes are so beautiful, I don't really like to use them for mashed potatoes. I would roast them. I would kind of boil them in really salted water and then roast them in a pan, getting really nice and crispy on the edges, and then just sort of finish it with some really nice fresh rosemary or sage.
And then I also just picked up quince, which is the only real beautiful edible quince that you don't really have to cook, from Windrose, that I'm putting in my vermouth like I did last year with the persimmons. This year I'm doing quince infused into Dolin Blanco vermouth as another, you know, just a little aperitif and so forth.
Hello there. This is Barbara Spencer from Windrose Farm. My husband, Bill, makes the most incredible Parker House rolls.
Oh, I'm Delia Coleman. Romeo is my son. And I've got 5 boys and 1 girl. The new thing that I'm making this year as a side dish is jalapeno jam. And it is good.
We're also doing an apple and quince pie because this is our first year having quince harvest. We started growing quince. We put the trees in about 4 years ago, and we have pineapple and Smyrna. And we also have a very unique one now that's actually a Russian quince called Aroma Naya. And it's also edible raw.
Hi, I'm Rose Lawrence. I'm the chef and owner of Red Bread, and Thanksgiving is a very special time in my family. We consider it Piesgiving, so there's always going to be one turkey and at least 3 different kinds of pies. This year, I'm making a lot of sweet potato pies using Japanese white sweet potatoes from Milliken Family Farms and topping it with our homemade marshmallow fluff that uses buckwheat honey from Burt's Bees.
I'm learning to be a pie baker again after years of farming a whole lot. I don't have a lot of time in the kitchen. Bill actually does a lot of the cooking, but I'm a big fan of Nancy Silverton's apple pie recipe, which has a total foolproof thing of pre-cooking the filling before you put it in the crust. And I do follow her crust recipe to the comma dots and everything else.
So to make pumpkin pie from a fresh market pumpkin, it requires a little more time investment. You always want to get a sugar pie pumpkin or really nice sweet varietal. If you want to make a pumpkin pie style but not use pumpkin, kombucha squash stands in beautifully for it. You're going to want to roast those at 350 until they're nice and soft. You can stick it with a fork. We like to brush ours with a little olive oil and put a sprinkle of cinnamon just to start bringing out the flavor. Then you puree that, combine it with cream, eggs, a standard custard pie, put it in a nice shell, and you got what you don't need to get out of a can.
Wow, that was amazing. Now I'm going to have to like completely reinvent everything that I had planned for the menu.
Every year, I think I know what I'm going to make, and then we do the show, and I get all these new ideas.
So, Evan, pumpkins, canned, fresh? I mean, fresh is always so frustrating for me.
Libby's all the way! it's not just the cooking it down forever. You still end up with a more vegetal flavor than I really want. And I have to say, Libby's with no pumpkin pie spices. Please take those particular constellation of spices and throw them away. Instead, I use tea masala, the spice combination that I get at the Indian store.
That's a nice idea. I think pumpkin pie spices are kind of like it's kind of like the white truffle oil of fall, you know.
And totally.
It's like, if you use it just a little bit, you know, it's like, oh, okay, that's a nice thing. But people, it's like, okay, a little bit of pumpkin and a lot of pumpkin pie spice. And you just come away thinking, oh, man, I could have gone to Starbucks.
It just reminds me of a candle shop. I can't believe that we managed to get through an entire Thanksgiving episode without talking about your mom's cranberry sauce.
Well, I knew we were going to come back to it, so I felt awkward bringing it up myself.
Well, it's got a lot of endorsements, including Jonathan Gold, who likes to add the touch of mulling spices to your mom's recipe.
Press Parsons' mom's cranberry sauce is really good, which is something people don't say about cranberry sauce that often.
So if you are in need of a cranberry sauce recipe this holiday, look for Mom Parsons' version on the Good Food blog or in the LA Times California Cookbook section. I know it's published in both places, and I know the one on our site has a picture of your mom, Russ, which is quite adorable. Russ, thank you so much for joining me again this year to help us navigate this really incredible food holiday.
Thank you for having me again, Evan, and happy Thanksgiving.
If you're searching for the recipes we talked about on today's show, they're all on the Good Food blog. We actually have an entire section of the blog devoted to Thanksgiving. All of our own turkey experiments are there. We've got recipes for Mexican turkey, Iraqi turkey, Adam Perry Lang's barbecue turkey. And then there was that year we did the turkey in a bedsheet thing.
The what?
Yeah, we had one listener wrote in and told us he almost burned his house down. Lesson learned. Thank you. Oh, people, if you only knew what we had on our heads right now. We have donned our turkey hats.
Our official turkey hats, thanks to Noelle Carter.
Thank you, Noelle Carter. I always wanted to have something, I don't know, brown and crusty on my head. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on demand on KCRW's smartphone apps. Happy Thanksgiving from all of us at Good Food. Jillian Ferguson, Laryl Garcia, Caroline Chamberlain, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman. I'll be back this Thursday with an extra episode of Good Food so you can listen while you cook that Thanksgiving bird.